Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Bernardo Batislazo. And in the podcast today, we had Art Carden, who's an economic professor at the Brock School of Business at the University of Samford in Alabama. We're going to be talking today about his book, Let Me Alone and I'll Make You Rich, How the Bourgeoisie Deal Enriched the World, co-author with Dreidre McCloskey. And I want to say that this podcast is produced in collaboration with Ranjit Dinghi, who's the editor of the Books Review at EHNet. EHNet is owned and operated by the Economics History Association with the support of other sponsoring organizations. You can find a link to the review of this book in EHNet. Art, thank you very much, and welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How do you decide to become an economic historian?
Yeah, so this is interesting. When I first started at graduate school at Washington University in St. Louis, I was interested in political economy and public choice and public finance and things like that. And I knew Douglas North's reputation. And incidentally, my then girlfriend, now wife, was taking a class at the University of Alabama. She's 2 years younger than I am, taking a class called The Mind of the South. So we spent a lot of time every night talking on the phone about Southern history. And I started thinking, wow, you know, this is something where there's a lot of neat work to be done. And I got really, really interested then in economic history. And of course, took the courses, worked with Douglas North and John Nye at WashU, wrote my dissertation on Southern economic history. Kind of got sidetracked for a little while because I've done a lot of work on Walmart, and that was supposed to be a one-off paper, and that ended up becoming an entire research agenda. But fortunately, in working on the book with Deirdre, and now I finally got to teach an economic history course this past May term for the first time in, gosh, over 10 years. So I get to return to my first love.
Thank you very much. That's super interesting. So how was it that this collaboration with Dreidre came about?
So a lot of this is, it's sort of an interesting object lesson in being in the right place at the right time and trying to put it and kind of putting yourself in certain places. I met Deirdre when I was in graduate school, and she probably the first major interaction we had was actually the weekend before my dissertation proposal. She presented the first volume of the Bourgeois Era trilogy at WashU, and my advisor, John Nye, asked if I would pick her up at the airport and then take her back. And the answer, of course, is yes. Do you want to, you know, spend 30 minutes in your car one way there, another way back, with Deirdre McCloskey's undivided attention? And so I got to do that. She found out about some of the work I was working on and thought it was interesting. I remember her exclaiming that I was ambitious when I told her I'd read the entire first draft of the first Bourgeois book. We continued to correspond over the next several years. And then in 2012, actually, we were both in the Competitive Enterprise Institute's iPencil video series. And they did the filming in Chicago. And she and I had lunch together. And she said that she was interested in working on kind of a shorter, popularized version of the Bourgeois trilogy and asked if I would be interested in being the co-author. And of course, the answer to that is yes, I would absolutely be interested in and willing to do that. And it was a fantastic experience. I learned a lot about, obviously, a lot about different things. There are a lot of ways in which, with respect to our collaboration, I'm kind of the Stephen Dubner to her Stephen Levitt, if you analogize our book to Freakonomics. But yeah, that's basically the origin story of Leave Me Alone and I'll Make You Rich.
And of course, for anybody who's not aware of McCloskey's work, the Bourgeois Trilogy is a three-part series that appeared between 2006 and 2016, in which she portrays her views on economic history and much else in about 2,000 pages. So yes, I think it's commendable that you've read the three volumes cover to cover and have produced something that us mere mortals can get to grips and then go to the main course in the relevant parts. So how is it then that you decide what to pick up from this massive piece of work and try to put it into general terms, because there's going to be a lot of choosing and what to leave in and what is going to be left out.
Right. So the book went through a lot of different versions. And in fact, it's actually kind of funny because like so much has been cut out and so much has been added in and things like that. There's sometimes I forget what's in the book and what isn't, or like what we cut out and things of that nature. But yeah, we spent a lot of time trying to ask, okay, what are these central and essential ideas? I had a bit of an epiphany in late 2018. I was actually teaching an Institute for Humane Studies weekend seminar at Faulkner University with my friend Jason Jewell. And I realized, the perfect book, the perfect version of this would be something that students could read, could do like an Institute for Humane Studies weekend seminar and read the entire book. Enough that they can do it in all of the sessions and something, for example, that could be used in an undergraduate course or even with graduate students if you don't want them to have to read the entire trilogy. But yeah, there we ended up having to make some hard choices about what to keep and what to toss. But we thought kind of our ideal reader is somebody who buys books in airports and who could like skim it quickly on, say, a flight from Birmingham to Chicago, or read it a little bit more carefully on a flight from, say, Chicago to LA. And that's kind of what drove what stayed in and what ended up on the cutting room floor.
Okay, excellent. So what was the, in terms of the hard choices, what was the hardest choice to leave out, if you can remember that bit?
Hardest choice to leave out? Oh, gosh, let's see here. I wrote a chapter about Ayn Rand that I don't think Deirdre liked as much as I did. So it's kind of hard to leave that one on the cutting room floor. I think I'm smiling as I say this because this is obviously there are some things on which we didn't completely see eye to eye, but of course she's the sort of senior author in the project and that was kind of tough. I had a chapter about retail that I ended up chopping out because and then this was kind of hard to do, but I wasn't sure about the sourcing on the chapter. So, the book was already pretty long. So there's some specific case studies and some specific examples that sort of get left out that, would have been fun to talk about. A lot of stuff about different authors and the ways that they were writing about commerce in the 16th century and 17th century and 18th century. Again, a lot of that is either remains in Deirdre's big bourgeois trilogy or in a bunch of other sources that we consulted that we ended up having to leave out as well. But Voltaire, I think, who said he apologizes for writing a really long letter. He didn't have enough time to write a short one. So we ended up having to, we had to make a lot of hard choices.
Yes, I can imagine. So let's get into the book itself, which is, as we agree, trying to bring out the soul, if you want to, of this trilogy and present it to a wider audience. So the basic premise, as I understand it, is how liberty has been fundamental in the development of and progress of Western societies and world economics in since the 16th century, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, liberty and dignity are the kind of the two key words.
Why dignity and why liberty?
So liberty first, just for the reason that every economist kind of understands. Open and competitive markets are important because when people have the freedom to pursue profit, they get resources into the right uses and things like that. Importantly, liberty matters a lot because it gives us the freedom to innovate, to look at some pattern of the way that the world is and say, you know what, I think I could do this better, and then be able to do that without having to ask anybody's permission or without having to worry about being thrown off a cliff, which was a problem in a lot of different places. And then there's also the question of dignity, where being, you know, a shoemaker, say, or in our modern context, getting a degree in accounting and being a good accountant is something that we think of as being a dignified thing to do. Being a merchant is not not something that we're as suspicious of as we've been historically. You mentioned things that we left out. I remember reading and I'm paraphrasing this from memory, but merchants in Italy would write in the front of their account books, you know, in the name of God and profit. And like they meant both. So first of all, the liberty to pursue profit. Second of all, the dignity to have a little bit of esteem for people who have made the world a better place. One of the ways that we, I know Deirdre put it in the Bourgeois trilogy, and that I think is important, is the world changed from a world where innovation was suspicious and heretical and looked down upon to a world in which they built a statue of James Watt for his innovations in the steam engine.
Exactly. I mean, there is this change in thinking about commerce and services in general, and as they become central to economic progress and economic development. So this would how would this link to the Industrial Revolution? As you've mentioned, James Watt.
Yeah, so we have this wave of gadgets that sweeps across Britain, and part of it again is at the margin, just like small changes in people's liberty to do things, and small changes in the degree to which we embrace, for lack of a better word, kind of a democratic capitalist system where anybody who wants to can try something, and again, it becomes. Upsetting old patterns becomes something that is not completely accepted and completely embraced, but at least something of which people are less suspicious. Again, I think it was, Queen Elizabeth, I guess, who said that the proper office of the soul is to obey. And we kind of pushed back against that a little bit. And I say kind of because obviously it was extremely incomplete, and there's probably a lot more that we can do. But we went from a world that rejected bourgeois virtue to being a world that embraced it. One of the examples we do use in the book is two plays, one The Shoemaker's Holiday and the other The London Merchant. And The London Merchant is very much a celebration of commerce and a celebration of business and a celebration of honest dealing and innovating and things like that. And The Shoemaker's Holiday, which had come out about 100 years before in the late 16th century, was really kind of poking fun at the idea that a shoemaker could be noble, or the idea that making shoes could be dignified.
Right. Let's briefly mention something that Joel Moore raises in his review. And that has to do with the Enlightenment, and more specifically with how something that goes hand in hand with liberty is this market for ideas, this application of ideas in everyday life, and also key to progress. The comment that is made is that probably this importance of how to make these ideas applied is somewhat left out, giving too much importance to liberty. So how would you respond to that, or how would you feel about that?
Yeah, so looking at the review, so he points out that he says that the Enlightenment plays no role in their account despite its commitment to ideas. If we didn't communicate that clearly, that's on us. The last chapter is about Adam Smith, and we're trying at least to convey the notion that in particular the Scottish Enlightenment was really, really important. Fortunately, my hope is there'll be a second edition someday. So this is something that I would want us to clarify, because there's a lot of complementarity between the story that that we're telling, or the story that Deirdre's telling, and the story that Joel Mokyr is telling about the Industrial Enlightenment, in particular in his book The Culture of Growth.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that, which is very, very helpful. And then let's go back and continue with the book. So the premise is you know, all of these changes are happening in the 16th, 17th centuries, are very important. We have the Industrial Revolution. But then how does this portray into the 20th and 21st centuries?
Yeah, so how do we apply this to the 20th and 21st century? I think we look at, and so I teach at a Baptist university that's very, very, very serious about its faith tradition. So I'll kind of put it in that context. So it's a place that, you know, our students are very, very good at wanting to help people, like very, very good at wanting to help people. It's not really clear that they're as good at actually helping people as they would like to be. And that's just true of any human being. Where I think the application could be in the early 21st century is recentering our idea of what it means to live a good and benevolent life. You know, a lot of churches, for example, they'll have like special commissioning services for, say, people who want to become missionaries. So they'll have like a special service recognizing that people want to become missionaries, or people going into the military. Sometimes some churches will do this. I've long said that I think it'd be fantastic if they held a similar little recognition ceremony for people who took the CPA exam, you know, something like that. Some people who went into innovative fields, or who again just decided to become a good accountant working for Deloitte or EY or another major firm, recognizing, I think, that say Jeff Bezos and Sergey Brin and Larry Page have probably done more to advance the cause of education, say, than a lot of people who have deliberately set out to advance the cause of education and to improve education and things like that. So, in fact, actually, in one of Mokyr's articles, he refers to Google as the world's best research assistant. And I think about this every time I try to do something. I can look up enormous amounts of stuff and find enormous amounts of information that a few decades ago I would have had to go to a library to dig up. That's something that I would want more people to appreciate, that you can make the world a better place without necessarily directly and specifically intending to. And to note that positive sum transactions and innovation are in fact virtuous.
Right. Yes, that's interesting. And I'm sure that not everybody would agree with that. I'm not challenging it. I'm just saying that it can be you know, well, we have difference of opinion. I'm saying that having one with you. But then how would this book, do you think, would be received by you mentioned thinking of selling it in airport. How do you think, or how would you like it to be received by, say, your somebody working in a corporation, somebody working in industry?
Mm-hmm. I think it would be, I would like for somebody working in industry, so somebody like who buys it and reads it on a flight from Chicago to LA for a conference or something like that. Yeah, they recognize that in fact, like what they're doing is in a lot of ways the fountain of prosperity. That we got rich we created this world in which what we refer to as poverty in the United States is fantastic wealth in historical perspective, that this happened not because of redistribution. It happened not because we started giving more or anything like that. It happened rather because we embraced an idea that, say, like Calvin Coolidge expressed during his administration, that, say, the business of America is business, and further embraced innovation and creative destruction by noting that the creative part tends to outweigh the destruction part when we're considering the long-run history of innovation.
Right. This would be a very Schumpeterian view of innovation and economic growth, no?
Yeah. So it's... I would like to think that, yeah, so we should, you know, obviously, when Amazon comes along, you know, maybe small local booksellers get knocked out of the market, though that's ambiguous. Or when Walmart comes along, companies that compete directly with Walmart are probably not going to be long for this world. We should note and acknowledge the fact that, you know, someone who puts their entire life into a mom and pop shop that gets, quote unquote, run out of business by Walmart, I mean, they've experienced a real and genuine loss, and we should acknowledge that and try to help them. But at the same time, it's also worth noting and worth embracing that, again, the creative part of Walmart's entry or the creative part of Amazon's innovations far, far, far outweighs the destruction part insofar as they contribute an enormous amount to general human well-being.
Right. So what would be then your final thoughts on the book in terms of, you know, how is this second edition looking like? What is the feedback you're getting from other people on the book?
Yeah, so the second edition, and this is just something I hope happens at some point. We haven't formally talked about it. The paperback is coming out, I think, in November. But yeah, my idea for or goal for a second edition would be just, you know, collect things like like the points that Joel Mokyr raises in his review, where either I think there's a lot more agreement between what we're claiming or what we're saying and what he's stating in his review, and bringing that out a little bit more, highlighting the complementarities better, adding new evidence as it's come up, because that's one of the things I've noticed is just how rapidly new information emerges and how rapidly new scholarship comes along. We've gotten a lot of feedback, and in fact, actually, I think we say in the acknowledgments, like, email me if you have questions, comments, corrections, etc. And were we to do a second edition, I would like to basically take what we've heard, evaluate it carefully, and then amend the text accordingly.
Thank you for that, Kurt. So, what is the, while that is on the back burner, or rather on the back burner, waiting to see if it happens, what is your next big project? Where are you working on these days?
Yeah, so next big project, I have a handful of things. A couple of co-authors and I have a paper about retail innovation, specifically the careers of Saul Price, who did a lot of things, but launched the warehouse club revolution, ultimately, and Sam Walton. That's going to be in Essays in Economic and Business History. I'm doing a lot of work right now about the South African economist William Harold Hutt, kind of digging into his ideas about institutional change, realizing that there's a gold mine there. There's a lot of stuff that Hutt said and that Hutt was doing first in thinking about the transition of Great Britain out of World War II, and then second, thinking about transitions in post-colonial Africa that apply a lot of important ideas we see, for example, in the public choice tradition. I have in the last several years done a lot of work on James Buchanan, winner of the 1986 Nobel Prize. I have a paper forthcoming in Business Ethics Quarterly on Buchanan's ideas about the work ethic and what that means for economic growth. And again, and potentially the possibility of increasing returns. And then I have a handful of articles right now that I'm working on for the Elgar Encyclopedia Public Choice on slavery, capitalism, socialism, apartheid, the transitional gains trap, and coercion. that should be available. Well, they're due on September 1st, so they'll definitely be available on the Social Science Research Network in draft form at least by then.
Super. That's very interesting. So where of the multiple things that you've mentioned, how are you getting the archive material to talk about our South Africa?
Yeah, so a lot of what we're getting there is from the Hutt papers specifically. So my co-author Philip W. Magnus has made a couple of visits to the Hutt papers at the Hoover Institution. So we have a lot of things directly from his papers. Something I'm discovering is the amount of really interesting archival material out there that is available online. Obviously, most libraries have online collections and things, but we were able to find, and this is actually a paper, our new paper that is in the Independent Review, we discuss an exchange between Hutt and an African religious leader named Z.K. Matthews, who actually spoke and gave an important lecture at the University of Cape Town in the early 1960s. And they're corresponding about what Hutt calls the need for ironclad constitutional protections of property rights in a world of post-colonial transition. So this, again, is Google serving as the world's best research assistant. We're able to find a lot of archival material out there that we may not actually even have to travel to visit an archive in order to get. And again, if you're familiar, if anybody listening is familiar with Phil Magnus's work, he's I don't know that the guy sleeps, and he has an incredible command of archival resources out there. My hope is to get out to Stanford at some point, maybe in the fall, and dig around in the Hutt papers a little bit. We have another potential collaborator who's an expert on South Africa who's going to take an excursion to the University of Cape Town for us while he's in South Africa in October. And we'll just try to scrape together whatever we can get.
Super. That's super interesting. Thank you very much, Art. Thank you very much for being with us at the New Books Network, and hope to have you again soon with a new book project.